Thank you. Well, thanks, Will. And thanks to all the organizers for inviting me and, more importantly, for organizing this workshop, which I found to be very useful. I've learned a ton already, and not just in this room, but also in the coffee breaks and the dinner, especially last night. Mashiq did a nice job of walking us through all sorts of issues. Very helpful. So normally I tell audiences, don't hesitate to ask questions as I go along. I don't think I need to tell you that. Just keep on. That's fine. All right, so let me give you a quick outline of what I want to talk about. So first I'll talk about LIGO and Virgo, where they stand in terms of sensitivity progression to date and the prospects in the near. And I said far future here, but I'm not going to go as far into the future as Salvo did. I'm really going to focus on the next, say, 8 years or so, 6 to 8 years. Then I want to talk about the continuous wave searches that we do. In particular, I want to start with the assumptions that we make, and those include the most promising emission mechanisms. And this won't surprise you, we've focused primarily on neutron stars to date. And then I'll talk about some of the issues involved in trying to assess the most promising sources and sky directions. Then I want to talk about the methods that we use to do those searches and show you some of the results to date. I want to spell out some of the challenges that come up in doing these kind of searches because they will affect the searches we might do for super radius. It's more or less the same problem. Although in some respects, we think super radius is a bit easier. Most likely. So I'll categorize the searches that we do. I'm going to focus on all sky searches. Sylvie will talk about a couple of other types of searches we do. And then I'll talk at the end about what would change if we went after super radiance more explicitly than we do now. All right, so let me begin with the fall 2015 run, the famous 01 run. This shows you a cartoon of the interferometers as they existed at that time with the Fabry-Perot arm cavities. And as a reminder, we have 10 milliseconds of light travel time, which is also 10 milliseconds of gravitational wave travel time between the sites. That's helpful, of course, for excluding terrestrial disturbances to understand that something truly is astrophysical. It's also helpful in triangulation, which I'll come back to a bit later. Here is the sensitivity we had in the Hanford, that's over here, Washington interferometer. And the blue is the Livingston interferometer. So this is the amplitude spectral noise density. The units are inverse squared of hertz. And the frequency range here goes from roughly 20 up to about 2 kilohertz in this picture. The value you see down at the bottom is a little bit below 10 to the minus 23. And let me explain what that means in a second. Actually, before I do that, let me just point out that there is a difference between the red and the blue curves. The Hanford data is a little bit better than the Livingston data in that data run, meaning that the curve is lower, the noise is lower. And that made it possible to detect binary black hole mergers more sensibly with... Am I doing that or... I walked into that one. I walked right into that one. So it's doing that for you too?
Yes.
Okay, I thought maybe I was so close to it that I was...
Can you tell the microphone, maybe someone can come help?
We don't know what's going on with this projector. Maybe it's the construction that's happening outside, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. The LIGO mirrors, they're more sensitive than we are.
Yeah, okay. All right, so anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about this noise floor you see down here. 10 to the minus 23, you know, what does that actually mean? To say the noise floor is down there. So here's a rule of thumb to understand how to translate an amplitude spectral noise density into an amplitude that you might care about astrophysically. So basically, the detectable signal amplitude is the amplitude spectral density at the characteristic frequency of that source, which is very well defined for a CW source and less well defined for, say, a transient signal. Divided by the square root of the coherent observation time, that is the duration of the signal that you can track coherently. And then you have to multiply that number by some trials factor slash geometry factor that takes into account how many different signal templates you've looked at, and also just the raw geometry of where your source is relative to your detector. All right, so let's go through a couple of examples to understand this. So in the case of our first detection, the binary black hole merger, in September of 2015, we had a... duration of about 0.2 seconds. So we're dividing by a relatively small number, and we have to trials factor of something like 10 for claiming a clean detection. That's about the right ballpark. And so from that, you would say that our sensitivity was several times 10 to the minus 22. Anything bigger than that, we should have been able to say, yeah, that was a real detection. Now, the actual amplitude of that thing was 10 to the minus 21, so it was a blazingly loud signal for us. It was great. Nature was kind to us, not for the last time. In contrast, a CW signal, one that we might be fortunate enough to track for an entire year, would give us a division by the square root of 3 times 10 to the 7 seconds. In that case, we end up with characteristic scales down at the level of 2 times 10 to the minus 26. So it's orders of magnitude below the amplitude that you could detect with for a transient signal, which is great. However, in practice, most of our CW searches are not nearly that sensitive because we do have very important trials factors, not to mention that we can't always, in fact, we often cannot, get a detection statistic that scales like the square root of time in a sensitivity. It often goes like the fourth root of time. So, in fact, in reality, we typically have sensitivities, say a 95% confidence level upper limit, in the ballpark of 10 to the minus 25 up to 10 to the minus 24, depending on just how bad those trials factors are for a given analysis. All right, let me just remind you that in that first data run for Advanced LIGO, we had a couple of 5-sigma detections of binary black hole mergers. I'm not going to belabor this, but again, you can see that the signals were louder in Hanford than the Livingston because Hanford was more sensitive in that data run.
I'm asking, trial factors, would they be overcome if the source is long-living and then basically you see it and then even if it's not coherent, you repeat the same measurement and you see again the same source? So,
that's great if you can do that, yeah. So in a given data run, if we see a signal, then we could just wait. If we weren't absolutely positive, we could just wait for the next data run, and yes. And if we're lucky, and it's actually not a crazy idea. In an all-sky search, we might see something, a hint of a signal, zoom in on it, something I'll talk about a little bit later, and see a fairly strong signal. And then we could actually go back to an older data set. We might be able to see that same signal, and that would help with that trials factor. That's right. Okay. But typically where it hurts us most is at the first stage of a search, because we have to set an initial threshold for that first stage. And that's where the trials factor hurts most. Once you see something, then you can tease it out sometimes. All right, so that was the 01 run, fall of 2015. Now the plan in 2016 was to get ready for the 02 run at the end of the year. And there were actually two different fronts on getting ready. One was mitigating some of the non-fundamental noise sources seen in the 01 data, all sorts of things like vibrating motors, electronic interference, all sorts of things that in principle should be solvable. And then the other issue was to raise the laser powers to reduce the fundamental noise at higher frequencies, essentially to reduce the shot noise. The problem that we anticipated running into at higher laser powers was something called parametric instability, where you have a positive feedback mechanism between oscillating light in the optical cavity, the Fabry-Pérot arms I showed you a moment ago, and vibration modes of the mirrors, something that's actually pretty nasty. Normally we deal with negative feedback, positive feedback is bad. All right, so the plan was to essentially focus on those two commissioning goals. All right, so at Livingston, pretty early in the year, we had a significant mishap, and that derailed completely the high-power plans for Livingston. And so that was sad, but the commissioners did a fantastic job of going after this first bullet, namely mitigating the non-fundamental noise sources. They knew all sorts of things that needed to be fixed, and they spent their time fixing them. And they did a splendid job. Hanford, on the other hand, did not have that mishap. They did go up in laser power. They successfully coped with parametric instabilities. And we now have a nice program for dealing with those. But realized kind of late in the year that there were some new non-fundamental noise sources that had not been seen before. And they essentially ran out of time to fix those. And essentially had to back off on the laser power because the higher laser power actually made those things worse. Okay, so in the end, when we started the run in November of 2016, we had a situation where Hanford was less sensitive in 02 than it had been in 01, but Livingston was quite a bit more sensitive. And so they flipped in terms of which one was more sensitive in 02 versus 01. And you can see that here. This is the comparison of the Hanford sensitivities. 02 is in the orange, which is actually higher than the blue curve for 01. In contrast, over here in Livingston, we have this relatively nice, clean noise floor in 02 that was lower than it was in 01. And that helped a lot later on. Let me just point out that this place where we had a nice improvement in Livingston was helpful for detecting binary black holes, and ideally for young pulsars too, and ideally maybe QCD axion. Okay. All right, here are the three binary black hole mergers that have been published so far from the O2 run. Again, I don't want to belabor this, but it's, you know, it's nice to have these signals. Let me highlight this last one on the bottom right, because that was the first one that Virgo was able to see. And that was a really nice benchmark for them and for us as a collaboration. Being able to see a signal in Virgo is very helpful for the triangulation. I showed you there's a 10 millisecond light travel time, or gravitational wave travel time between Hanford and Livingston, and having yet another pair of baselines between Hanford and Virgo and Livingston and Virgo helps us triangulate the directions of sources. I'll show you an example a bit later. All right, and then here we go. This is our golden event in last August where we had a binary neutron star merger. Salvo showed you a picture of where he was in the Netherlands when he was looking at this picture. I remember where I was when I saw this spectrogram. We all remember where we were when we saw this thing. It kind of knocked us out of our chairs, if we were sitting down. Okay, maybe some people fainted. I don't know. But it was just a fantasy come true to see something like that. All right, so there was a lot of fun after that. We had these arrangements with electromagnetic observers. The signal afterward, the merger, essentially was seen in its aftermath in gamma rays. It was seen in optical about 10 hours later when the sky got dark enough in Chile. And six different telescopes found the optical counterpart within about an hour, thanks to our telling them where to look. I'll come back to that in just a second. The signal was also seen in UV and optical. IR, eventually it was seen in X-ray and radio. So just a splendid example of multi-messenger gravitational wave astronomy. And we had a paper that came out, a so-called letter with more than 3,000 authors and 70 different collaborations. So this is fantastic. Those of us in the CW search group were enjoying this and kind of chipping in wherever we could. But at the same time, it was hard not to have source envy, because we'd like to have fun like this, okay? And let me come back to one particular point. So I said that the triangulation with Virgo was very helpful. Let me just illustrate that here. If we had only Livingston and Hanford to work with for that event, then the triangulation in the sky is shown by these blue bananas, which is not bad. It's not terrible. When you bring in Virgo, you get something that's much smaller. Now, Virgo didn't actually see the signal, but the fact that, or with any significance, but the fact that Virgo didn't see it meant that the signal had to be somewhere near the antenna mode, excuse me, the antenna node for Virgo, and that was very helpful. And of course, that's where the observers looked, and that's where they found the merger aftermath. So I just want to point out that the CW group can do a whole lot better than that. Okay. If we had a signal and we could track it for a year, then essentially the aperture of our interferometer, and that's what it really is a year-long interferometer measurement, would be the aperture is the Earth's orbit. And so we get down to sub-arc second resolution on the pointing for a source like this. So that's our fantasy, is to tell observers exactly where to point to find something interesting. Okay, looking ahead, this gives you a projection from a recent paper. We've been updating this periodically for the last several years. These are projections for sensitivity improvements over time. So in the, this is Advanced LIGO, this is Advanced Virgo, and this is Kagra, which will be coming online next year, we hope, to take some data with us. It's in Japan. Where we ran in the first observing run, 01, was basically toward the bottom of this blue band, which was on our schedule, so we were kind of ahead of schedule in terms of our sensitivity. Where we ran in 02 was sort of halfway down the green band, and where we're hoping to run in 03, which will start probably January or February of next year, is to be in the top of this orangish-brown band. So we're shooting for something like 120 megaparsecs for both Hanford and Livingston. And what I mean by that is the distance to which we could see binary neutron stars with a standard signal-to-noise ratio of 8 averaged over the sky.
It's not going to be the bottom of the red.
It is not likely to be the bottom of the red. I mean, it'd be fantastic if it were that way, but there's, you know, 120 will be challenging enough. But that is thought to be doable at both interferometers.
And the issues with the high power at Hartford have been fixed. So have you, what is the status of the experiment?
Yeah, so we had a status report just a couple of months ago at our last collaboration meeting. And the plan was to, the plan and the expectation was to have 120 megaparsecs sensitivity for both interferometers by the end of this year. Since then, we've had a couple of minor mishaps, basically the glass fibers that hold up the mirrors. We've had a breakage at both observatories since that time, and that has led to something like a month or two delay. In one case, a month delay, maybe less than that in the other case. So, you know, those things happen. You know, it's unpredictable what mishaps you'll run into, but we're still expecting to have 120 megaparsecs by January or February. Okay, and then looking a little bit beyond that, there is a pre-proposal that was just recently submitted to NSF to build an upgrade to Advanced LIGO called A+, which would take us from this design curve here in yellow down to this curve in green. So it's roughly a factor of 1.7 beyond Advanced LIGO's design sensitivity. So projecting from where we are now to then, we're expecting to see something like a factor of 3 improvement in sensitivity, strain sensitivity, at the higher frequencies from, say, 200 hertz and on above, to get to design sensitivity, and then another 1.7, roughly, to get to A+. So close to a factor, somewhere between 5 and 6, improvement in strain sensitivity in, then say, the next 6 to 8 years. That's our expectation. That's not a promise. That's just what we're hoping. And Salvo showed you some much more ambitious goals for well beyond that, getting into the 2030s. All right, so let me talk now about the CW searches and the assumptions we make in those searches. We field a diverse suite of programs to cover a variety of source scenarios. That diversity applies to the source types. Those include isolated neutron stars, which are the most straightforward, neutron stars and binary systems, which can introduce quite a bit of complication, neutron stars undergoing accretion, which can, in some sense, simplify things if we're lucky, if we have torque balance. Newborn neutron stars, including a binary neutron star, post-merger hyper-neutron star. Glitching neutron stars. This is an area that we're really just ramping up in right now. We haven't paid a lot of attention until the last year or so. This is something that's a very active area of development right now. And then, of course, there's black hole super radiance. Okay. Our diversity also applies to our algorithms. And so we have match filters when we have a lot of information about our source. That's the ideal situation. We have time domain heterodynes. It's another alternative to match filters. We have semi-coherent power sums. I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit later. We have loose coherence power sums, which is a sort of an expansion of that idea. Huff transforms, Viterbi dynamical programming, which is turning out to be pretty powerful. We have something for binary systems involving sideband summing, and something called two-spec, which refers to double Fourier spectra. We've done a lot of different, we've gone after these things a lot of different ways. Our assumption is that we're looking at this kind of a radiation where we have a...
So let's imagine the following scenario. Imagine that someone tells you the frequency at which to expect the signal with some, say, 1% precision. Mm-hmm. So what I have in mind is, you know, super radiance.
Yeah.
Plot spin versus mass, you see spin deficit, and from that you extrapolate to an axial mass.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say with some good precision. Would that accelerate your search for direct signatures of that?
That would give us better sensitivity. Now, I'll quantify that a little bit later. Okay. If I forget, remind me, but I have a slide that will address that to some degree. All right, so we assume we have this kind of a model where we have a strain disturbance, a metric disturbance, that is proportional to the second time derivative of a quadrupole moment. And unfortunately, the factors out front are amount to a very, very tiny number, so we need something that's violent. And one thing to realize is that we get no gravitational waves from an axisymmetric object that's just spinning about that symmetry axis. However, if we had something that had a little bit of non-axisymmetry to it, if we had a principal moment of inertia around the x-axis was different from that around the y-axis, then we can quantify that by the difference of those two moments of inertia divided by the moment of inertia around the spin axis itself. We call that the equatorial ellipticity. And if you had that kind of equatorial ellipticity, you would get these kinds of gravitational wave strain amplitudes. So we have 10 to the minus 24 for a source that's a kiloparsec away, that has a gravitational wave frequency of a kilohertz or 500 hertz for its rotation frequency. And it has an ellipticity here defined by this equation at the level of 10 to the minus 6 and has some nominal moment of inertia about the spin axis. All right, so this is a big number. 10 to the minus 24, we used to think was a small number, but now that's pretty much a piece of cake for most of the searches we do nowadays. That would be considered a very loud signal. However, it still assumes an epsilon value of 10 to the minus 6, which is actually also a big number compared to what you might expect. I'll come back to that in just a second.
This is like a centimeter-sized mountain or a neutron star or something?
Yeah, it's basically the ratio of the height of the mountain, the height of a bulge. Well, an isolated mountain's not good enough. You really want to have a bulge across the equator. Yeah, so it's roughly the ratio of that height to the radius of the star. In that case, we have a strain amplitude that's directly proportional to that ellipticity, and the gravitational wave frequency is twice the rotational frequency. Another scenario would be something that does not actually have non-axisymmetry in the structure of the star. It could just be an ordinary oblate neutron star that's spinning very fast. But if it's wobbling, if the angular momentum and the angular velocity axis don't line up, if the star is precessing, then we could get a signal that's proportional to that poloidal ellipticity, which we think is non-zero for an ordinary neutron star, times that wobble angle. And that would give us gravitational wave frequency at the rotational frequency plus or minus precession frequency.
Doesn't epsilon, is it constant with time? Other than the frequency drift of the neutron star and this precession, does the bulge, can it go away and come back?
Yes, unfortunately, it can go away. It can anneal itself. So that's the worry, is that even if you had something that perturbed the star for a while, over time it would smooth out.
Okay. But they have no idea. What's the expectation for
it? I'll come back to that in just a second. But I attended a workshop in Seattle with some nuclear theorists just a few weeks ago, and the upshot of that conference is that we have no idea what the ellipticities are, and that's been the way for a long time now. But at least we have a better communication with them in terms of we'd really like to know, what is reasonable, and it's just very, very hard for them to calculate that. And I'll come back to an example of that in just a moment.
Will you talk about whether or not, if it just migrates in phase, but it keeps the same, period and everything? So something like this, imagine a spiral neutron star from an accretion flow or something. Is that something that you'll address or that's possible?
I'm not going to address it too much. Sylvia is going to talk more about accreting systems, I believe. But one example would be Scorpius X1. That's a very bright X-ray source, and our hope is that that's a case where the X-ray, I think I mentioned this yesterday when I asked you a question, in fact, we'd like to have it be the case that the angular momentum that's being deposited on that star by the accretion is balanced by the angular momentum carried away by gravitational waves. And in that case, if we're really in that kind of equilibrium, then the frequency should be reasonably stable over the kinds of observation times that we do, although we do allow for a little bit of wandering due to accretion fluctuations. But if you're talking about an isolated neutron star that has, whatever accretion may have happened in its past has stopped, then we would expect that ellipticity to slowly dissipate with time. Okay, another scenario that somewhat far-fetched, but something we think about, is a two-component crust and superfluid. It's kind of a special kind of precession where you end up with gravitational radiation at both the rotation frequency and twice the rotation frequency. And then there are R modes, which are unstable modes of oscillation that are actually somewhat analogous to superradiance. It's something that is dynamically unstable. And in that scenario, we end up with a gravitational strain amplitude that is proportional to the amplitude of the oscillation of the R mode. And the gravitational wave frequency would be roughly 4/3 the rotational frequency, but there are significant corrections that are not necessarily calculable with high precision. Okay, so the assumptions that we have made when it's been necessary to make assumptions in these kinds of searches, which is most relevant to the targeted searches, has been that our best bet is the bulge, looking for this equatorial ellipticity. So we look for gravitational wave emission at twice the electromagnetic frequency. For example, the Crab pulsar, which has a source frame rotation frequency of roughly 29.6 hertz, is going to be seen in our detectors, if it's detectable, at roughly 59.3 hertz. And that's uncomfortably close to 60 hertz, which is a problem in North America because our power mains run at 60 hertz. And it's really, really hard to exclude contamination from power lines. This is actually farther from 60 hertz than it used to be because that star is spinning down. Since the start of initial LIGO, it has actually gone down several tenths of a hertz. And that's nice. Our noise gets better and better as we get further away from 60 hertz. Okay, so let me address the question. How large could the equatorial ellipticity be? I'm not answering the question how large it is. I'm addressing the question how large it could be, okay? So the old maximum that we thought back in the early 2000s was that it was something like 5 × 10⁻⁷ times the ratio of the breaking strain of the crust divided by 10⁻², where we thought 10⁻²  was about the right number. Now, there was a nice calculation done by some nuclear theorists, including one of the organizers of this workshop I mentioned in Seattle recently, Doug Horowitz, that found that, in fact, from numerical simulations, the breaking strain is actually more like 10⁻¹. This is essentially taking condensed matter techniques and applying them to a neutron star crust. And so that means that this, in fact, could be, you know, 5 × 10⁻⁶. And in fact, there's been a recent reevaluation by Ben Owen and Nathan, who is here somewhere. There he is. That says that the equatorial ellipticity could be as large as 10⁻⁵, doing a more careful calculation.
Is it dependent of the equation of state of the neutron star?
No, it's not. It really depends on it. So, In fact, to get the really large ellipticities, you want a puffy star with a small surface gravity. So, actually, the recent, by Newton Tower's recent say it's likely to be more, it's not probably say more compact, and that's a smaller.
Smaller ellipse.
Yeah, this is pre-discovery.
But you're actually, that means you're constraining reasonable parameters.
That's right, yeah. It's useful to have these measurements. But again, this is the maximum. This is not what you would think would be typical. Okay. All right, so let me talk about the basic categories of searches that we carry out. There are three broad categories. I'm not going to get too much into the fine details. Sylvia's going to talk about two of them. I'm going to talk about one of them. So the first type is a targeted search for known pulsars using ephemerides from pulsar observers. Those can be radio, X-ray, or gamma ray ephemerides. So that gives us exact phase tracking over periods that can be up to years. Our most extreme case was 23 months back in the initial LIGO days for the S5 run. So that gives us a very low trials factor. We're not having to search over lots and lots of different signal templates. We know pretty much what the template is. So that helps a lot. We do have a variation called the narrow band, which will allow for electromagnetic or gravitational wave mismatch in frequency up to 10⁻³. Now, you were asking about 1%. This is a tenth of a percent. And we've done those kinds of searches, and I'll show you that we get degraded sensitivity as a result of that. There are directed searches for sources where we know the location precisely, either because we actually see something that looks like a neutron star, or we think it's an interesting place to look, like the galactic center or the center of a globular cluster. In those cases, we don't know the frequency, so we have to search over frequency, and we end up with a fairly large trials factor as a result of that. We have to treat isolated binary sources separately. We can do fully coherent searches, the equivalent of doing a Fourier transform, but making corrections, I'll talk about in a moment. Or we can also up to days or weeks, and we can do semi-coherent searches over full data runs. Okay. And then we have the all-sky searches, which is what I'm going to talk more about. And Sylvia will address these first two in more detail. So again, in the case of all-sky searches, we have to treat isolated and binary sources separately. As you might imagine, the binary case is especially challenging if we are looking at an unknown point in the sky, and that source has unknown binary orbital parameters with some other companion. And these are done essentially all as semi-coherent searches, where we cannot practically do a fully coherent search from the get-go for all places on the sky. So why? Well, I'll come back to why that is in just a moment. Before I do that, though, let me just give you a sense of the sensitivity we have for these targeted searches. These are the results in searches for known pulsars in the O1 data. We looked at 200 of them. The blue stars are the upper limits derived from that data set. It was a 4-month data set. The upside-down triangles represent what are called the spin-down limits. These are the strains you would expect if these were what we call gravitars, namely stars whose rotational energy loss is entirely due to the emission of gravitational radiation. So all the energy that you can infer that's being lost in rotational kinetic energy is going into gravitational wave emission. And so you can see that in most cases, the triangles are well below the stars. So we're not really getting close to that in most cases. But there are a handful of cases shown by these pink circles where we actually do beat the limit. And the most notable example of that is a crab. I'll give you a number in just a second. Now, if you look at this entire ensemble of limits, the very best limit is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 26. So that's about 5 orders of magnitude lower than what we discovered in September of 2015. The best upper limit on ellipticity does not correspond to that particular strain because the strain strength that we see depends on the ellipticity and on the square of the frequency. So looking for very low ellipticity upper limits pushes you up toward higher frequencies. But the best that we get down to is 1.3 times 10 to the minus 8. Yeah,
question. One question. When you target these 200 known pulsars, you target them individually.
Exactly.
Has there been any effort in trying to combine all of them?
Yeah, there have been some studies of that. In fact, I think there's a methods paper in progress right now. I think I saw a draft at some point. In principle, you can do a little bit better by combining them. There is a tendency, though, for the closest guy to be the one that dominates your sensitivity. But you gain a little bit. I'm not sure. Max, do you recall it's like 10 or 20% kind of improvement?
You just get back your prior for the population. Yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't help you a lot when you have, you know, say 200 discrete sources. That's different from, say, a stochastic background where you might have billions of sources out there, way out there. Okay, as I said, the crab is a case where we beat the spin down limit the most. Back in the mid 2000s, we were really happy when we beat the crab spin down limit by a factor of something slightly greater than one. We call that beating the spin down limit on the crab, and we got an FA letter out of it. Now we're beating it by a much larger factor, and if we quantify it in terms of energy loss, we can say that no more than 2 parts in 1,000 of the energy loss of the crab is attributable to gravitational wave emission. We're pretty happy about that, but we'd be even happier if we could see something non-zero. Okay, so let me get back to this idea of how sensitive the different types of searches are. So we defined something called the sensitivity depth because we got frustrated in all of our discussions in the CW group in trying to compare one algorithm against another at various frequencies and for various data runs of various observation times. Yeah.
I guess it's for you.
Yeah.
The fact that we have seen the binary neutron star merger, can you use the data to constrain? Does that agree with the expectation that you're finding that epsilon is less than 10 to the minus 8?
In the actual value you see for a given neutron star depends on its history. So the maximum you can is a property of the neutron star material, but the actual value for a given neutron star depends on, you know, did it eat a planet recently or something like this?
Okay.
So isn't it the case that neutron star being 40 megaparsec, like we would not have seen anything anyway unless it's in
talking about the equation of state. So the you have just enough statistics from the binaries, can that feedback into what you can expect for the...
Yeah, presumably that tells us something about the typical value, but not about the extreme values that we might see first in a search.
I see.
Yeah, so of course we're hoping to find an outlier, you know, some unusual neutron star, particularly one that might have undergone recent accretion.
Also, the Horvitz papers that Keith mentioned, it basically says that you can get a 10 to the minus 5 ellipticity due to the crust alone. So it doesn't really rely on... really strange things going in the core. So if you were to get a big hammer and hit a neutron star, it will actually stay in that shape and emit the gravitational waves. The big question is, what will that hammer be or some other mechanism? That's what actually limits understanding.
I should say that at this nuclear theory workshop I attended, one of the big questions that came up is, what is the minimum ellipticity that's reasonable for a neutron star? And we don't know the answer to that. It might be as high as 10 to the minus 9, but it might be significantly below that. It's likely that the minimum is going to be defined by buried magnetic field. That if you have this, we normally think of these things as magnetic dipoles, but in fact, it's expected that for a stable neutron star that's been spinning for a long time, there's quite a significant toroidal field buried inside that star.
Yeah.
And it's possible to have asymmetries in that toroidal field that could give us ellipticities that may be in the ballpark of 10 to the minus 9. So that was the homework that we asked the theorists to go ahead and go off and work on. And I'm hoping that we'll see a paper emerge at some point that says it can't be any lower than this. If one thing that was noted in that workshop was that there aren't very many spin down limits that are much below 10 to the minus 9. There seems to be something of a floor there. And there's no natural reason to explain that other than perhaps, you know, there's some physical mechanism that maybe we are starting to see evidence of gravitational radiation from the floor of that distribution. But that may just be fantasy on our part. Okay. But anyway, it's an intriguing possibility that there is a minimum. And we're within an order of magnitude of that potential minimum. Okay, so as I said, we need a way to compare our different algorithms on different data sets, different frequencies, and so on. So we came up with something called the sensitivity depth. It's basically a rule of thumb comparison that's helpful. And it basically is defined to be the amplitude spectral noise density at a given frequency divided by the strain. Divided by the 95% confidence level strain for that particular signal. So if we derive an upper limit from a given search, we can use this as a benchmark to say this is, you know, either good or bad. The basic idea is that sensitive searches have a greater depth. All right, so that's the basic definition. Here's a table comparing, roughly speaking, how these searches perform. So if we have the case of a targeted search where we have the exact ephemeris from pulsar astronomers, and we can track that source over a year, then we can get down to something like, or get up to something like 500, okay, which is, you know, not bad. If we do the narrowband search I talked about earlier, where we're allowing for one part in 1,000 relative frequency change, that hurts us by about a factor of 3. If we went to 1%, it would hurt us by another factor of something. I don't want to quote a number off the top of my head, but it's...
What is the difference between the directed isolated search and the targeted search?
The targeted search is the one that uses the exact phase information from pulsar astronomers. This one, the directed isolated search, you don't know anything about the frequency. It's a wideband search. We know where the source is or where we think a source might be. We don't know what the frequency is.
So the question of what Savas was asking before is that...
Would be closest to this one.
Yeah.
So Doki, the sky location would not be known.
Oh, I thought you had in mind a particular...
frequency.
Oh, just the frequency, not a location. Oh, in that case, then we're... Well, we don't actually have exactly... We don't have exactly that search here, but...
67 is what
I would guess. Yeah, I would guess, yeah. That agrees with my intuition. That if you were... if you didn't know where the source was in the sky, but you knew the frequency to a percent, I'm thinking that's about right, you know, 60, 70, somewhere in there. Okay, and then we have semi-coherent directed isolated searches. Again, source location is known, but the frequency is unknown. And this is basically combining together many segments of data where the segment length is limited by the computational cost of the coherence time. We can also do searches for Scorpius X1 or other low-mass X-ray binary systems where we know the orbital period fairly precisely. And in the case of a four-month search, we get a depth of about 80, not bad. If we're doing an all-sky isolated search over 4 months, these are numbers based on our recent paper, we get to something like 25. You can do a little bit better than that with Einstein and Holm if you restrict yourself to to the low frequencies, but that gives you some sense of how much we suffer in going from a targeted search to an all-sky search where we don't know anything about the source frequency. And then the worst case is the all-sky binary search. As you might guess, that is the least sensitive one because there's so much more that we don't know about that source that leads to a larger trials factor or if you like, larger thresholds.
So for these numbers, you scan the frequency for the ones that you don't have a narrow band or a specific frequency.
Yeah.
Do you also scan the drift? So
we do, yeah.
So this includes F dot and F double dot?
Yes, and it depends on what the coherence length would be.
Yeah.
So for a young source like Cassiopeia A, which is about 300 years old, then those higher order derivatives are pretty important, and we have to scan over a relatively large range. So it's true that if you had a super radiant suspicion from some source, you would not have to search over as large of a spin down range as we do in these cases. That would help you, but not by an enormous amount. I mean, the trials factor would go down.
Yes.
But you're still probably not going to...
But wouldn't it help you also with the coherence time? Because you don't have to... The signal won't drift out of your band. So can you computationally, can you just run your...
Yeah, up to a point, sure.
Up to a point. It's not a lot.
I'd have to work through the numbers, but... It would correspond to doing what we consider a search for an old source. And we've done that sort of thing, looking for sources that we thought were a million years old. And we have actually done, the extreme of that was looking for Calvera. We actually never published that because pulsations were found from Calvera before we got around to publishing it. But that was a case of looking for a coherence time. I believe that was close to 2 years.
Oh, wow.
But that was a special case. That's an interesting question. Given how small the spin-down space is, how long can we go in coherence time?
Okay, I mean, at some point, you have smearing of the line because of the environment. If you have some sort of accretion that's time-varying, that will smear your line. It won't be...
Yeah, if there's accretion,
But it will be a smearing of the line.
Right.
What about the qualitative aspect of superadmins that it keeps you spin up?
Well, that doesn't change anything fundamentally. I mean, we actually do searches that go to positive spin up. We typically have something like 90% of our search is spin down, but 10% spin up, just to be, in the spirit of keeping our eyes wide open.
But are there normal physics sources that give you spin up?
Not to the degree that we look. So again, it's a sense of, it doesn't cost us that much more. It's 10% extra computing cost to do it. Why not just do it? And cover our bases to some degree. But the proper motion would not give us this kind of level of I mean, we go overboard if you think only in terms of conventional sources. We go further out and spin up than we need to.
Yeah. So what kind of coherence times need to count these numbers?
Okay, so it varies quite a bit here. So the AllSky isolated search over 4 months. These coherence times depends on which pipelines we're talking about. I'll actually show you some examples a bit later. But depending on the frequency, they're ranging between something like 2 hours and a half hour coherence time and just adding up lots and lots of segments. And if you're doing an all-sky search, you can't get to extremely long. When I quoted that number to you for 23 months for the extreme coherence time, that was for a directed search. Okay, or directed search is the phrasing we use, where we know exactly where it is. We cannot do that for an all-sky search. Can't begin to do it. In fact, I'll explain that in just a moment. So this is of order an hour, a little less than an hour, a little above an hour, depending on the frequency range we're looking at. This is a half hour or less for the AllSky binary search. Directed isolated search, this is 10 days coherence time for a young source like Cassiopeia A. Older sources, you can go to longer coherence times of order several weeks in the extreme. And the semi-coherent directed isolated search, those actually, Badri would tell me the number for that one. You recall, say the...
2 days or something?
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's sort of comparable to what's used in Einstein at home, because these are, in fact, Einstein at home searches, the semi-coherent directed searches.
Can you just ballpark what kind of CPU hour numbers are we talking about for these searches?
So if you think about like 10,000 CPUs running 24/7 for about 6 months.
Yeah, so for Einstein at home, we're talking tens of thousands of CPUs. In the case of the searches we do on our individual clusters, they range anywhere between, say, a million core hours to maybe 20 million core hours or more. It's in that scale. Any other questions before I go to the next slide? Okay. All right, I was just going to comment that these depths affect how we choose to focus our resources on searches, both computationally, as you might guess, and also in our human resources. And it actually cuts both ways in the sense that if you have a great sensitivity depth, that means, well, we've got, there's a promising source, so we can spend a lot of time going after that. But on the other hand, if you're thinking we're not really doing a good enough job here, then you can spend your own time developing new algorithms. In fact, one example of that is this directed search for low-mass X-ray binaries. That 80 was something more like 25 just a few years ago. we had a pretty vigorous effort to improve what we do in those kinds of searches. Okay, so let me talk about some of the challenges we run into with all-sky searches. There's a serious technical difficulty just from the fact that the Earth is moving. So the Earth is spinning on its axis once a day. That gives us a detector velocity over C of about 10 to the minus 6. And of course, the Earth is going around the Sun. That gives us V over C of 10 to the minus 4, a modulation over the course of a year. So a coherent integration of 1 year, which is what you'd really like to do ideally in these kinds of searches, gives us an intrinsic frequency resolution of about 30 nanohertz. And if we're looking for a 1 kilohertz source, that means that the Fourier transform that we like to have be a single Kronecker delta function in that Fourier transform, in fact, is a incredibly low-lying plateau over millions of bins. And so it's very hard to see that thing unless you make exactly the right corrections. We also have to worry about daily amplitude modulation of the antenna pattern. It's a 12-hour period, a 24-hour period. That modulation depends on the polarization of the source. As it, to say, it depends on the orientation of the source. There are two angles to worry about there. And of course, there are these frequency derivatives we have to worry about in some of our searches. And if we're looking for a binary source, then we have the orbital motion to deal with, and we may not know much about or anything about that orbital motion. So these things complicate the analysis enormously. So a simple Fourier transform is completely inadequate. We have to search over many different possible demodulations. And unfortunately, the number of different sky locations we have to search depends on the coherence time. And it goes like the square of the coherence time and the square of the frequency. And so if we wanted to do something like a year-long integration, there just aren't enough computers on the planet to do that. The total computing cost scales roughly as a sixth power of the coherence time without taking into account a second frequency derivative. That's just the first frequency derivative. And we would have to take into account the second frequency derivative in looking for neutron stars over the course of a year. So an all-sky survey at the full intrinsic sensitivity of a detector simply is not possible, at least at this time.
So can you just go through the six power again? So there's two powers from the sky location and then one power from the frequency.
Yeah, let's see. So we've got, this is the computational cost, including the time to go through the data itself. You've got a search over the frequency. You have a total number of points that scales like the square of this. You have the frequency, you have the frequency derivative, and then you have the time to go through the data volume itself. So it's number of templates times the amount of data. Okay, so we have to make trade-offs to cope with these truly astronomical computing costs. And the easiest way to do that is to restrict your coherence time being less than several days for an all-sky search. And so we can compute demodulated spectra, there's something called the F-statistic, which I'll mention repeatedly as I go along. This is something that is quasi-match filter. It's not exactly that, but it's close to it. And it essentially, you can exploit the coincidence among different time segments. So you take an F-statistic for, say, 2 days, another 2 days, another 2 days, and you look for outliers that are coincident among those different segments. So the sensitivity for that kind of a search scales like the square root of the coherence time, or SNR, I should say, goes like the square of the coherence time, but you're limited by this requirement of the coincidence. A better way to do it is to use semi-coherent stacking, where you have a number of stacks equal to the observation run time divided by that coherence time. And so it's a better way to combine those things rather than looking for a coincidence. And so one way to do that is to take the spectral powers and add them up just straight, raw arithmetic averages. That's not a great way to do it. It's better to use weighting that takes into account the antenna patterns of the detectors and the noise variations, the non-stationarity. We can also use thresholded powers, use Hough transforms, look for a particular pattern in the histogram that would indicate a signal satisfying a particular template. And then again, there's this F statistic where you can use these demodulated spectra for, say, 1 or 2 days, and then add those on top of each other, being very careful to keep track of the possible signal evolution from one segment to the next. And in this case, in all of these cases, the sensitivity improves only like the fourth power of the number of stacks, which is to say the fourth power of the observing run. Okay, so that's not great. You like to have a square root of time dependence. We have a fourth of time dependence, but it's still better than sticking to just this coincidence kind of analysis. All right, now I've whined a good bit about the problems with doing these all-sky searches. But there are some benefits from these Doppler modulations that give us so much trouble. One of them is that the reality of our signal is confirmed, at least in principle, by the very need to make those corrections. Because we're not going to, we would not expect a terrestrial source to have these kinds of modulations. And then the corrections also give us a precise directionality on the source. This is an example from one of our semi-coherent searches showing you what an injection looks like in our data. And there's a nice red spot there. And once we see that red spot, then we can essentially zoom in on it. And there have been a number of algorithms developed in recent years to do this in an efficient way using different approaches. And in principle, given this kind of ability to zoom in on a source and get to a very high SNR, in principle, a single interferometer could make a definitive discovery. Now, given our experience and the rattiness of our recent data, I'm not as confident of that statement as I used to be. We've had some really nasty lines, which I'll talk about a little bit later. All right, so let me go through some of the methods we've used in searching LIGO data and Virgo data. The coherent F-statistic I mentioned earlier, that was first tried out with a coherence time of 10 hours way back in 2007. That was really a demonstration, not a serious search by today's standards. We've done these stacked power spectra, stacked slide and variations on that, where we've had two coherence times of order an hour, a little less or a little bit more. There's the traditional stacked slide method, which is not very optimal, but is better than nothing. The Sky-Huff transform, which is definitely an improvement on this. Something called PowerFlux, and a souped-up version of it using what's called loose coherence. And we have a frequency F transform. And then on top of these stacked power spectra, we also have these multi-segment F-statistic searches, where the coherence time is of order a few days. And again, I said earlier that if you stack these F-statistics, you do a better job. Coincident F-statistic is one way, stacking is better. And Einstein at home has demonstrated that's really the way to go when using F-statistics. Okay, so here are some results. This is from our most recent All-Sky paper from the 01 data set. Let me just talk about some of the structure you see here. This doesn't look like the kind of spectra that I showed you earlier, and these are not the kind of spectra you see in our usual public talks, and that's because we're using long coherence times for which these lines become much more apparent. So let me talk about the lines that ought to be there and the lines that should not be there. These lines belong there. What you see at roughly 500 hertz are what we call violin modes, and those are basically vibrations of the glass fibers that suspend the mirrors. And that's basically KT, that's thermal noise. And we can't get around that, we're stuck with KT. And the idea is that we have very high mechanical cues for those fibers so that we put as much of that thermal power into this narrow frequency band as possible so as not to pollute the noise floor around it. Okay? And in some sense, we've done a good job. We have nice loud signals here. Ideally, we should not really be seeing these harmonics up here. Those indicate nonlinear effects, but we do see harmonics. These are harmonics not only of the vibrations themselves, but also, in many cases, harmonics of the interaction of the violin mode vibrations with other oscillations in our detector. And that's called upconversion, and you can see evidence of that. Yeah.
Perhaps this is a stupid question, but since you know so well these frequencies, there's no way to subtract them from the noise at all.
They're thermal, so they're stochastic. So it's not as if we have a deterministic model. In some sense, you could do what you're talking about. You could try to use a Kalman filter and just track along and say, okay, the violin mode amplitude right now is this value, and let's try to subtract that off. But if you saw a signal, would you believe it? If the signal you're seeing is orders of magnitude below the thing you subtracted, it's hard to have much credibility. So we don't really do searches right on top of violin mode, although we try to get as close as we can.
Are they the same for all the detectors? I mean, the two LIGO and the Virgo?
Not exactly. LIGO and Virgo. No, Virgo is different. It's a different design. Hanford and Livingston are similar, because they're basically the same design. But in fact, we see differences of order 10 to 20 hertz in the actual observed frequencies of these lines. It's hard to control them that precisely. And in fact, the number of modes here is 32 in principle, because we have four mirrors, each mirror has four fibers suspending it, and each fiber has two transverse modes, and so you get these two eigenvalues that affect your result. So we have 32 modes here, 32 modes here, and so on. Not all of those are actually resolvable, but in principle, they're all there.
What are the steps?
I'll come back to that a bit later. Actually, I have an animation, not a real animation, but just, I'll come back, I promise. Okay, but so these are lines that, you know, essentially should be there. These definitely have to be there. Ideally, these should not be as loud as they are, but we have all kinds of imperfections in our interferometer that enhance the sizes of the harmonics of these violin modes.
And I'll go back to what Masha asked. I mean, can you use the fact that they're not overlapping to reject them between the two detectors? Do you need the same level of coincidence that the transient signal needs? Can you work with a single detector?
So I made the claim that we could, in principle, detect something with a single interferometer.
Yeah.
In practice, we don't really try that in the violin mode region. In fact, we don't try it at all because at this point, we're focused on the relatively clean regions. In principle, perhaps we should pay a little bit more attention to the lines that are, the bands where there's a line in Livingston but not in Hanford, and vice versa. It's one of those situations where how do you choose to spend your time? We do searches in those regions, and if we saw something interesting and it were loud enough, I think it would poke up in our analysis. You know, Vladimir?
So on this plot, actually, if you look at those yellow lines, or the black lines, the upper limits actually valid in the violin mode regions. And the H-naught is quite a bit above what you get for the best value. But it, for example, favorably compares with the bar upper limits that was set a while ago. So these are actually useful upper limits that one could use for some sort of general perspective, but of course this is not where we would expect to detect. So detecting means that you need to be able to show that what you got is a real signal, and because of all those nonlinear effects, it's just...
It would be nice to have two detectors seeing the same signal, not to mention three. as Vladimir pointed out, the upper limits are still valid, but they're two orders of magnitude higher or so. And so then also other structure you see here is 60 hertz, 120 hertz, 180 hertz, so the harmonics of the power mains. And then we have some calibration lines that we need in order to operate the instrument. You can see some of those here. And then there's a lot of other stuff you see here, a lot of other structure there. And those are lines that we really should not have. In fact, most of these have now been fixed. We were shooting ourselves in the foot in a pretty stupid way. We realized after the run what we were doing and fixed that. So in our next data run, this will be a much cleaner region here. This region is much harder, and I'll come back to that in just a second. Now let me talk about these steps. So these steps are due to trade-offs in the algorithms that are used to do the searches. So basically what you're seeing in each one of these steps is a deliberate choice to shorten the coherence time to deal with the computational cost, or in some cases to deal with the potential loss of signal as you go to too long of coherence time, given the Doppler modulations. But basically, we're making trade-offs, and some of the algorithms had to make really big trade-offs in order to get results out. So the time domain F statistic is using of order days coherence time, and to cover this high frequency region above 475 hertz, they had to make a huge sacrifice compared to what they had at lower frequencies. So these are showing results from different pipelines. The black curve are the upper limits from the circular polarization case of power flux. Vladimir derived these limits, and also the yellow curves show the limits from linear polarization. So circular polarization corresponds to the most favorable polarization of our source, the most favorable orientation of that star, where you're looking right down the spin axis, or opposite to it. And then linear polarization is looking at the very worst case where the spin axis is at a right angle to your line of sight, and looking at the very worst polarization orientation of that. And so this essentially bridges our sensitivity in that this is the very best case, this is the very worst case. And then what's more typical is something in this region. And the other searches for which there are limits shown here are doing population-based averages where they average over all those possible orientations.
Why doesn't that have the lines?
I'm sorry, which one?
The blue, which is black.
The blue. The
doesn't have the lines.
Yeah, there's been a certain amount of cleaning up in that case. And also, you have to realize that there are of order 2,000, there are 2,000 search bins in every frequency, and then there are choices on how to show those results. So there's been a certain amount of exclusion in some of these limits that are not being done in the others. I would say in some cases, the limits are just more complete. You can't see the gaps that are there.
Can you say something about what is the effective, what is the useful frequency width compared to the the actual limits shown here?
I'm not sure I understand your question. The useful frequency?
So it's roughly 2,000 hertz on the diagram. Is it 1,900 that's useful of that, or how much gets excluded due to these lines?
Okay, so I have a question for this group later on related to that issue. But basically, we are guided in this upper end by our prejudice about neutron stars. So the fastest spinning neutron star is 716 hertz. We're expecting a signal at twice that, so 1,400 hertz. And there are 2,500 pulsars known in our galaxy. That's the very upper end. So we tend to think there's probably nothing beyond 1,000 hertz spin rotation. And so we say, let's just stop at 2,000, because it's extremely computationally costly to go to high frequencies. So it's basically, we could look 2,500, 3,000 even, but it's very costly, and we think the physics payoff is probably minimal, or zero. Okay, any other questions before I move on? Yeah.
Are there concrete advantages to the time domain F statistics over power flux, say? Maybe it's faster to compute, or do we have it just to have a multiplicity of strategies? Because it seems like it's...
Well, we had a mock data challenge some years ago, and the pipelines that competed in that had comparable sensitivities. They were within tens of percent of each other. So it's nice to have that kind of redundancy, especially given that there are different coherence times used in these different analyses. So it gives us more confidence we haven't missed something. We're just covering the ground a little bit better. Okay, so we can translate those upper limits into astrophysical reach or range. This is a particular type of plot that shows you families of curves corresponding to different assumed distances to the source. This is implicitly assuming a gravitar model where the spin down that you see is entirely due to gravitational wave emission, just ignoring other possible contributions such as magnetic dipole emission. And so the vertical scale here is the actual frequency derivative that you assume. In our searches, we don't go above 10 to the minus 8. At least we do not do so in this particular data set. And so you can see, for example, the 1 kilohertz curve, at the highest frequency, we get down to an ellipticity of about 10 to the minus 7. It gets a lot worse than that at lower frequencies. And you can see these diagonal dashed lines, blue dashed lines, indicate constant values of the ellipticity, again, under the assumption of a gravitar model where this frequency derivative is determined by gravitational wave emission. And so if there's some other contribution to the spin down, then your limits are essentially getting pushed down to shorter distances. And this is something that we might, I'll come back to this a bit later, but this is something we might want to do in the case of super radiance, is come up with a corresponding kind of a plot. We had a nice discussion of that at dinner last night, how we might show limits on super radiance in this kind of a way. All right, so I wanted to just point out that at low frequencies, I hinted at it in my earlier plot. This is zooming in on essentially the same results I showed you a moment ago, but also including results from one additional pipeline. There's a lot of structure here that should not be there. All these little dots you see floating up above the noise floor, those are evidence of instrumental lines, some of which we were able to fix between the O1 and the O2 runs, but not all of them. These are all sorts of things, again, where we're shooting ourselves in the foot. But in some cases, it's hard to figure out how exactly we're shooting ourselves in the foot. So some of these things are still there in our O2 data, but it is better than it was in O1. And finally, the last set of results from the LSKY isolated star search I wanted to show are the very lowest frequencies up to 100 hertz. So these are the same sorts of limits I showed you a moment ago, where the power flux limits have been converted to a population-based set of limits. And then this gray-black curve here shows you the results from Einstein and Holm, which is able to dig deeper into the data by using longer coherence times. But there is a large computational cost associated with that, and so they only went up to 100 hertz for this particular run. Okay, let me talk briefly about unknown binary systems, the LSKY search for binaries.
Sorry, updating your computing power, is it in the works? Is it possible? Would it give you? Is it just cost effective? Does it make
sense? It doesn't help us that much. Okay. Our our strain sensitivity scales like a very low power of the computational cost. You know, in the extreme case, it's like the 14th root of our computational cost. That's the extreme case. It's not always that bad, but, you know,
yeah,
it's pretty bad, depending on the type of search.
One place where it does help is that, say, if you get the speed up of out of 10, instead of improving the sensitivity of H naught itself, you can go for a wider parameter space.
Okay.
So, for example, you might be able to cover binaries using same methods you use for an isolated all-sky search if you had more computing power. And also the kind of computing power is different. So if you gain access to hardware with some sort of dedicated features, then you might be able to make use of it. But all of that is expensive.
Okay, so far we've only done one published all-sky binary search using this two-spec method. It had to make an enormous sensitivity trade-off to cover this enormous parameter space. There are some other algorithms that are on the horizon, we hope, or at least under development. One's called the radiometer method with using sidereal folded data that's coming out of our stochastic search group. And it's not yet clear how sensitive that will be, but that may be an alternative to two-spec. There's a polynomial method using short coherence time filters and coincidence among them. And there's also been a suggestion, not really a pipeline developed, using autocorrelations of spectrograms, sort of similar to two-spec, but computationally more efficient in principle. Okay, here are the results from an initial LIGO search. The corresponding results from 01 are still under review, so I can't show those to you. But I'm expecting to be something like a factor of 3 or actually a little more than 3 below this. This is showing you, again, limits for circular polarization, which is the most favorable case, and then the red shows you the random orientation limits. Not quite as bad as the worst case, but you know, sort of typical of an average star. And this only went up to 500 Hertz because, again, this is computationally expensive to do. Okay, so let me address what changes in our searches if we go explicitly after super radiant. So first of all, we have a couple of different models that I know about, string axions and the QCD axions, and they do have somewhat different properties. I'm going to, I think it was Sam who used the BLT acronym, I'm going to use my own TLA to refer to this paper, the ABH paper, because I'm using some of their results. But I also want to point out this other pair of papers from last year that made me realize that there are some, the actual projections are more optimistic than I'd appreciate, and I have the impression from dinner last night that there's some agreement now that these rates are in agreement with analytical calculations. So I'm going to focus here on the QCD scenario where we have weak self-interactions and only comment briefly about the string axion case. So if we have level transition emission, then our mass range is restricted to something like 1 to 6 times 10 to the minus 11 electron volts. If you go to the full 10 to 2,000 Hertz band that we normally search, I should say that 10 is pretty aggressive right now. We don't really do serious searches below 20 Hertz right now, but we hope in the coming years to get down to something close to 10 Hertz. This is assuming this 6G to 5G transition and a 10 solar mass black hole. So this is a case where the signal frequency is determined by the axion mass, but also by the self-interaction that might be present and a varying square of a black hole mass. And of course, we still must deal with Doppler modulations. There is a spin up parameter space that is small but non-zero. It could be important for very long data runs we might have in the future. And these are not a great source because the events are thought to be rare, something like once per stellar lifetime for about 10 years. So we'd have to be pretty lucky to catch one of those. Much better is the annihilation emission scenario, which is a long-lived source or relatively long-lived. The mass range that we could in principle be sensitive to goes from 2 times to the minus 14 up to 4 times to the minus 12 electron volts. And here the signal frequency is determined by the fixed axion mass primarily, but with some small quadratic corrections in the square of the black hole mass. And again, we still have to deal with the Doppler modulation. So the spin-up parameter space in this case nearly vanishes. It may be that we could just assume that it's always exactly what we expect it to be. That would be especially helpful for very long observation times. It's also possible that stochastic gravitational wave searches could see a superposition of many, many sources outside our galaxy in a relatively narrow band. And so natural question is, are we more likely to see it from a stochastic sum in a relatively narrow band, or are we going to see a resolved closed source first. So let me ask you some questions, pose some for consideration. Could we get significantly better sensitivity by narrowing the search parameter space, by going after exploit the smaller magnitude of the frequency derivative? So my answer to that is not really, because I've got this word significantly in there. You're not going to gain a factor of two from doing that. You might gain 10, 20% from doing that because your trials factor is going to go down. It's not going to go down by that much. I don't think it's going to help you that much. But it's something we can do. We could just take our existing searches and focus in on the subset of them that cover very small spin-down magnitudes and say, well, we're going to quote separate limits from those. And we're talking seriously about doing that sort of thing or having searches that are tailored to look at only small spin-downs. So that's a case where we might be doing a little bit better. If we miss it this data run, we'll catch it the next data run when our sensitivity is better, we collect more data. Something that's more of a worry would be if we had something like strong self-interactions in, say, a string axion that was causing the frequency derivative to be significant and perhaps completely unpredictable. We might miss it entirely with our current searches because we may not be looking over broad enough spin down or spin up range. So that's something that we're probably not going to do anything about if it goes outside of the ranges we look for now for neutron stars. But we do have this fallback that is possible stochastic gravitational wave searches would catch it anyway and then give us a hint that we ought to be paying more attention to very large magnitudes of the frequency derivative. I think the answer to this is yes. Is there theoretical consensus on these rates? I think there is now pretty good agreement between analytical and numerical calculations. So that was something that concerned me before the start of the workshop, but I think I've been reassured on that point. A question that arises when you're deciding how to spend your time is what is a better bet for going after super radiance? Should we go after these unknown isolated black holes, or all sky searches, or should we focus on known black hole binaries? I mean, we know there's a black hole over there, but the price we pay for going after that guy is he's in a binary system, and it's hard to do these binary searches with much sensitivity. So the all sky search, in some sense, comes for free, but searches for specific binaries come with non-trivial computing costs and analysis costs. And so we have to decide, what is the most promising source? And so that's something that we'd like to get some guidance on possible here at this workshop, is if we decide to go after some of these binaries, which ones are ideal? Ideally, it ought to be close and ought to have some medium spin range, not too high, not too low. All right. Another question that came up at dinner last night, which helped me understand this issue, is just how narrow is the signal band for the annihilation scenario? And normally the gravitational wave frequency is the twice the rest mass of the axion over h, and then there's this quadratic dependence on alpha, and that means that the spread in the gravitational wave frequency is proportional to the spread in alpha squared. Now, alpha itself is, if I've done my arithmetic right, looks like this. It's some relatively small number times a ratio of black hole masses to 10 solar masses, mu a over 10 to the minus 12. And that could be a small number when it's squared and divided by 2n squared. So that could be of order 10 to the minus 4. And so that means that the bin in which we might see a source could be extremely narrow, so narrow that it's actually within the Doppler spread we get from the Earth's orbital motion around the sun. And the minus 4 is the same ballpark. So we could be seeing something just a little bit wider than that, or even narrower than that. We hope we have this problem. that would be fantastic if we had to worry about this issue. And we did talk last night at dinner about the possibility that we should be a little bit more attentive in looking at the results from our all-sky searches to make sure that we're not just throwing things away because we're getting flooded with crap here. This is a... So we'll be a little bit more attentive to that in the future, just in case.
For the black hole binary systems where you might have motion in the black hole of, call it 100 kilometers a second or thereabouts, is that something where with an ephemeris you can easily sort of trace along that?
Oh, yeah. If we have the ephemeris, that's fine. That's not a problem. But if we don't know that precisely, then it means we have more trials factors. And that's the situation we face with Scorpius X1, where we know the orbital period very precisely, and we know that the time of ascending node pretty precisely, but the orbital modulation depth is not known all that well. So tens of percent. And so that translates directly into our computational cost. Okay, another question is, should we bother going above 290 hertz? We heard yesterday that for the QCD Axion, you know, the mass limit is below 600 to the minus 13. So why would we bother looking that high if we're trying to tailor it?
What do you
Well, what I'm saying, no, I'm saying that the limit is below that, but I'm saying if we go above 290, that means we're assuming this.
You mean for X-ray binaries?
Yes.
Well, in general.
No, generally, arguably, QCD may be much higher.
Oh, no, I'm saying, you're saying the evidence is from X-ray binaries, yes. I mean, James showed that, right. And then Sava showed this number yesterday. So I'm just saying that if I take this seriously and say that QCD axions are the only ones I care about, then I wouldn't bother looking above this frequency. But if I'm looking at string axions, maybe there's some scenario where that could be.
I think you should look because, I mean, it's also a cross-check of another. X-ray binaries are very special mm-hmm. things. So it could be that for some reason there's some sort of systematic there. So it doesn't mean that you shouldn't look. This is an independent way.
But... Well, our group is famous for looking for things that are really unlikely to be there. So so that's okay. We'll look. I'm just throwing it up for discussion that
but
if we were...
But it's a band because that's...
But then at the other side of the band, this is many thousands of hertz.
Right.
So that's outside of what they can do right now.
Yeah, so 10,000 hertz or so, and that we don't have any sensitivity up there.
So one thing that's helpful for looking for things that are highly unlikely, if there is papers that says that it is highly unlikely but could still help. then we can refer to that. Because otherwise, if there is a paper that says, well, that region is excluded, then there is a question of why we are putting out a plot saying that we'll...
So if you ignore X-ray binaries, then theoretically that mass range is preferred for QCD axions compared to this lighter one.
Practical...
When we wrote the paper, we said disfavored. That's why when Sava said disfavored. So
yeah, disfavored. Not ruled out as disfavored, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so...
Searches are expensive. The higher
exactly. So that's if we get it for free because we're already looking for neutron stars in that region anyway, then it's not a problem. But but Badri's point is a good one. Are we going to devote special effort?
But you can see also from the plot, right, that a factor of a few above at around 10 to the minus 12 or so, mm-hmm. the signal strength drops precipitously. So the probability that you see something is small. So if you go up to 1 kilohertz, for example, you don't have to scan that entire region. But if you go to up to 1 kilohertz, which you already do because of neutron stars, then you're probably fine.
Yeah, if we don't change our current searches, there's no problem.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of...
but 1 kilohertz is fine, because if you remember that plot, probably Masha showed you, that there is, go to high mass, the part that's inside the band, there's nothing much above 1 kilohertz anyway.
Right.
So as long as you're doing that, you're okay.
Yeah, and I think also just to clarify, I think you have too many significant digits on your 290 hertz. There's some...
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's one significant digit here. Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah.
And as I said, I mean, there could be self-interactions that somehow invalidate the black hole spin limits anyway, so we're going to look anyway. But given that, should we get really aggressive and go above 2 kilohertz? Well, that's very, very costly for all sky searches, and we're not motivated to do it for neutron stars.
That would be good for targeted searches. So if we talk to Jack later and find light black holes that would probably, if there were to be probe in action, that would probably be something in that range, then those are the ones that will be done for higher frequencies.
Or light?
The lighter the better. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the lighter that Jack can find and Javier can find, the better. So.
Well, we have one at 40 megaparsecs so far.
That's a bit too far.
That's
a bit too far. That's a bit too far, maybe.
That's definitely a high frequency.
About the magic number of 2 kilohertz. Is that our infrastructure for understanding the detector takes a hit above 2 kilohertz.
Yeah.
Precisely because of this assumption about the neutron stars. So for example, the witness channels record at the frequency so that we don't get data above 2 kilohertz. So it is hard to understand all kinds of detector artifacts. So the whole range above 2 kilohertz is not well understood. People didn't pay much attention.
Yeah, so that's another practical consideration, is that we have not really validated the data quality for these kind of searches above 2 kilohertz.
Oh, really?
Because, I mean, we have, you know, the transient searches do cover that region, but...
I agree. But we have... It's deep.
We don't go anywhere near that. That's 37 kilohertz or so. But in principle, we could go up to 8 kilohertz. That's roughly our Nyquist frequency for the data sampling. And that's where our sensitivity would cut off because of analog filters anyway.
Yeah.
So we actually have burst searches that go up to several kilohertz. And in principle, we could do the same. We have chosen not to go above 2 kilohertz because the neutron star prior tells us we're wasting our time to go up there, and it's very expensive.
Yeah, but the thing is that if we can find the target, if we tell you, look at that binary, does that make your life easier and say that...
It makes it easier, but it's still, you know, it's somewhat expensive to go... Well, it's more than somewhat expensive to go to higher frequencies, even for that case.
The detector is not well calibrated more than...
Well, it's calibrated well enough up to several kilohertz. I mean, we do have calibration errors that are thought to be reliable because the burst group has asked for that. We haven't asked for it, but the burst group has, and we do have a calibration up there. But Vladimir's right that there's a lot of crap in the data above 2 kilohertz. Some of it there by design because we told the commissioners, don't put your crap below 2 kilohertz, so they put it at 2100 hertz. There's a whole bunch of stuff out there that we would have to deal with, plus the other things that are, you know, not there by design. Yeah.
So is geo data usable as well? Because
By and large, geo data is not useful for these kind of searches because it doesn't take much of an inequality of the sensitivity between the interferometers for it to be a waste of time to look at the less sensitive interferometer in these kind of searches. So there's nowhere where geo is as sensitive as LIGO. So if I were really going to go after, say, 2400 hertz, I'd still use LIGO data. I would just have to go through the pain of going through that data to make sure I understood what those artifacts are, you know, cataloging them, which we've done below 2 kilohertz in excruciating detail.
So the other side of this is that there is no astrophysical motivation that we knew before this conference to make us go above 2 kilohertz, burst searches excluded. And so that if there was something, some motivation to provide that, that could actually serve as a trigger for us to start paying more attention to those regions, right? So
yeah,
you could point to something saying that, well, it is likely that we have this following mechanism, and at some place above 2 kilohertz, things might be interesting, or stuff can be happening. Then we can start looking at it, we can start looking at the data quality, and so on. It will be a slow process.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the continuous wave, but for high frequency in general, 2 kilohertz is a golden band for the closing merger of neutron stars.
So we started looking at that recently. One thing to keep in mind for the post-merger signal is relatively short. So it's interesting if you find it, but for example, you don't have to worry that much about detector stability, and you've got whatever data you put after the merger. So a number of considerations go away. And for these searches, because you average so much below the background, you start popping out instrumental lines that you just don't see in normal commissioning. And then you start asking yourself, is that a real signal or is it a nonsense interferometer? And one of the ways to answer the question is to cross-correlate with a channel that is definitely not GW. But many of those channels are just not sampled with so that we can do it above 2 kilohertz. And so that we'll have to ask the commissioners to make the samples of those high frequencies. And so there's a lot of stuff involved in that.
Yeah, there's a slide I should have included in this talk, which compares the spectra as seen by the commissioners, which is shown up on the control room wall, using coherence times of order seconds versus coherence times of order 2 hours or more. And there's a huge difference in what those spectra look like because of those lines I showed you earlier. And those lines are essentially invisible to the commissioners. So up above 2 kilohertz, you can still do transient physics and probably not worry too much about the artifacts that are there. But if you're looking for CW signals, you have to worry about all sorts of effects that have not received much attention. Okay, another question is, should we address super radiance limits directly in our papers using black hole population models, or should we do what we do now, which is simply quote limits on H-naught? Now, I'll just say that the prejudice within the collaboration has been not to quote limits that are not fairly definitive, as we don't want to quote limits that are going to change by a factor of 3 when the next theoretical paper comes out about black hole populations or whatever it might be. So we're probably not going to do that, but something we could do, and we talked about this at dinner last night, is to quote ranges for, say, a fixed black hole mass and a family of axion values, saying, well we can see this out to this distance. Or we could do vice versa. We could fix mu sub A and look at a family of black hole masses and so on. So that might be a little bit more informative to your community in interpreting our results without our being unduly sensitive to fluctuations in theory.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Okay, all right. Okay, so summary. So our searches are very diverse, both in what we look for and the algorithms that we use to do that. We do try to keep our eyes wide open. We're famous for doing that in our group. But we do have to make choices about how we spend our computational resources and how we spend our own time in doing analysis. We have mainly assumed the galactic neutron star is our most promising source, and that black hole super radiance just comes for free. You know, we'll see that automatically. If that's not true, we'll need to know that if we're going to have good sensitivity. And I think it is pretty true for QCD axions. If the super radiance gives us stable frequencies, we should be safe. If self-interactions give us significant spin wandering, we might miss it if the spin range is outside of what we spin down range or spin up range is outside of what we look for currently, or if there's some stochasticity about that process. We still might catch the extragalactic signal from stochastic searches, however. I'm not sure how much we should worry about this, but if you think we should worry about this, let us know. And then there's this other issue of should we focus on particular black hole binaries? Because that is a choice of spending our time, our computational resources, and our own time on going after a particular source. So that does not come for free. That would require a fair amount of effort on our part. So as I said earlier, we'd like to know what the most promising sources are and would go after those first. So your guidance is welcome on all of these questions. Yes. Thank you.
Just in addition to black hole binaries, promising things could be your recent black hole mergers, right, as we saw.
Yeah, that's a good point. I should have included that in my slide. But keep in mind that the directionality is pretty important, and what we get from transients is pretty broad. If there's no optical counterpart, which would probably be the case for a binary black hole merger, then we're going to have very poor directionality on the sky, and that affects computational costs enormously.
But there could be black hole neutron star mergers, which would
help. Yeah, that's fair enough.
For those probably, because those are going to be extragalactic sources, you will go to higher values of this parameter alpha, and then you will have more significant frequency drifts. So probably that will limit your coherence time. So probably you won't be able to integrate for days or even...
The signal may be short anyway.
So the frequency drift for those you should be aware that would probably more significant.
Also, very far away, you might not be able to choose interior.
Well, it depends. I mean, there are. So, for example, we've been talking about axions, but for spin one super radiance, the signals are significantly stronger. And you could have I don't know in your paper you looked at this right so how many events per year were you expecting for
dozens
of events per year for advanced light depending on the mass.
I mean targeted follow-up searches that depends also on the black hole how many black holes you see and also. Yeah, you probably have to do a slightly different analysis because of the shorter signal.
I'm just curious, the closest and most well-localized freshly formed black hole is from the binary neutron star. What kind of frequencies could that emission be at? Is it way too high frequency to look for?
The annihilations, yeah, that would be above 10.
Of course, we're looking for it anyway, from the hyperneutron star spin down. But that works in progress.
Yeah, but for going back to target searches, what we were discussing with Jack, I guess we need to have a more detailed problem. We'll do it during dinner, as it looks like. So you need lighter as black hole as possible in the binaries that are far away from each other, in a binary that they. Two objects are far away from each other so that they don't disrupt the cloud, and the speed is low to medium.
And then we have to see, there may be some optimal range in alpha and the mass of the axion that each object targets, so that you don't even have to wander too much in frequency when you do that search. So that's something that we need to discuss and see.
So when you said low, I think, Jack, you had the closest source is 0.12 in its spin. Am I remembering that correctly?
The lowest spin is about essentially consistent with zero.
Okay.
Yeah, well, let's discuss this.
Okay.
I have a question, actually. So do you do a stochastic? So first of all, for the stochastic signals, I think you would also see weak signals from our galaxy. That those might actually be the dominant ones.
Those will almost always dominate. And the galaxy is brighter than the rest of the universe put together.
I see.
If it's if there's anything in the galaxy.
Okay.
I don't know if that's completely true, because extragalactic will never spread due to the redshift of the frequency.
But yeah, so the galaxy is better in that it's in a shorter waveband and it's strong. So that's both they're both helping.
Yeah, I guess maybe Richard will talk about these signals a bit more tomorrow. But
so we do. The stochastic search group does do those kinds of searches. And so they have something called this all sky radiometer search.
Uh-huh.
And they've developed a new souped up version of it that's computationally much, much faster than what they used to have. So we're hoping to see some results from them soon.
Okay.
They have relatively coarse frequency bands compared to what we do, but that may be appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Okay. Thanks.
Good. So
okay.
Maybe this is a good time to break.
Only half an hour.
Since we're half an hour, let's be back here for the next
time. Okay.
Yes. Thank you.